Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Part of the credit for Donald Trump's victory must go to young voters between 18 and 29. Vice President Harris still won that voting bloc overall, but a smaller margin, but by a smaller margin than President Biden did in 2020 against the same candidate. Most of this shift of allegiance came from young men. Trump won them by 16 points, and that has sparked conversations about what attracted them into his camp. Many believe it was the tone of the president-elect's campaign rhetoric, very macho, somewhat rough, and occasionally dipping into the use of words and phrases that would have doomed any previous candidate and has been deemed unacceptable by most voters in real life. Trump also spent time with influencers and podcasters who make their living as purveyors of the so-called bro culture. Their references can tilt toward misogyny and could be characterized as locker room talk. Negative campaign rhetoric has been with us a long time, and it is often difficult to explain to children as they witness the politics of future leaders unfold, but this year, something was different, more crass, more vulgar. And once you start going down that path, it may be one of no return. So this hour, a look at how young people form their political and civic identities, how this new media landscape is influencing them and why, and how to talk to children about what they just witnessed and the words and ideas that were expressed quite publicly by a man who will soon be in the Oval Office. Margaret Hagerman is a sociologist at Mississippi State University and author of the 2024 book, Children of a Troubled Time, Growing Up with Racism in Trump's America. And Rachel Gianfassa publishes The Up and Up. That's a newsletter on youth political culture on Substack. She explores Gen Z's political zeitgeist and how and why they are or are not participating in the political process. Good morning, both of you. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's Rachel. It's radio, so you have to talk. Rachel, I'm going to begin with you. You've been covering young voters for a while, first for Teen Vogue, then MTV News. You write for the New York Times and other publications, and now you are part of you were part of CNN's politics team covering young voters, and now you've started this Substack publication, The Up and Up. A lot of people were surprised by the inroads that Donald Trump made over Kamala Harris, particularly with young voters. Were you?
Not particularly, no. I've been traveling, as you mentioned, over the course of the past, particularly 2 years, talking especially with young people in states across the country, mainly in battleground states. And it was very clear that there was more of an appreciation for now President-elect Donald Trump's rhetoric than there had been. I had many young men in particular tell me that it felt more socially acceptable in 2024 to be outwardly pro-Trump, including on what are deemed as liberal college campuses, and that there was just less of a sort of shock when these young men would express their beliefs, though I will say there still is some hesitation to do so. And so just the frequency and the excitement around the former president, now president-elect, I was not surprised to see the support, especially from young men.
Were they attracted to his ideas fundamentally, or were they more attracted to the way he conducted himself in this kind of swaggering manner and some of the words that he chose to use that have not been traditionally used in public gatherings? It's usually used behind the scenes.
I think it's a little bit of both. You mentioned in your introduction this idea of locker room talk. That's something that has come up in my conversations with young men in particular. And there is a sort of disdain for political correctness amongst a cohort of young men in particular, young women too, a desire to be able to speak freely that flies in the face of cancel culture that we certainly see from President-elect Trump. And that is something that appealed to this cohort. But at the same time, the number one issue in polls over the past year for young voters, regardless of gender, regardless of race and ethnicity, has been the economy. And Trump talked about the economy in a way that I guess resonated with these young people. And that when it comes to the issues, young people are voting on issues. And that is, I believe, the number one issue that drew them to support him.
So, Maggie, there is this backlash against political correctness. Much of it is justified, quite honestly. But then there's also decorum. There's political correctness and maybe fighting against that. But there's also traditional decorum. Think the way we conduct ourselves around others that seems to have changed. Are we witnessing a fundamental shift in what is and is not acceptable in our society? And if so, what does that mean for younger people, children coming up?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I don't know exactly. I can speculate, though, based on my research with particularly children in what we would consider to be middle school, like 10 to 13. And certainly there's a lot happening in schools with kids that age. We learned from Trump's first term that, there was a lot of harassment, between different groups of children. Specifically, certain groups were targeted by those that were in support of Trump. There's been a lot of research, including some stuff by the Southern Poverty Law Center called the Trump Effect, of how, children were negatively impacted not only by Trump's policies, by his rhetoric. And so I think that, when you have children in schools or on school buses fighting with each other about politics when they're 10 years old or 11 years old, and there's no adults that are willing to engage in any meaningful conversations with them, and rather instead they're silenced, I don't think they're learning the skills of living in a multiracial democracy. And so your question about decorum makes me wonder, what happens when they continue to grow and they don't have those skills, and what does that do for our country in terms of our how polarized we are, et cetera. So I don't know exactly, but that's sort of what I would gather based on my research.
Well, the great Stephen Sondheim wrote a song called Children Will Listen, and the words go, "Careful the things you say, children will listen." They do pick up cues from the adults in their midst. They do pick up cues from the adults they see on television. I noticed at a lot of these coverage of a lot of the Trump rallies, men and women both were wearing a pair of paraphernalia shirts, sweatshirts, that described Kamala Harris as using the B word on their sweatshirts. He used the B word. Donald Trump used the B word, I think, in referring to her at one point in his speeches. What are we telling children when we don't lash out at that?
Well, I think we're telling children that kind of violent language, I suppose you could call it, is acceptable and it's okay. And children learn about the social world from so many different places. They have so many different messengers, including seeing images of people, or maybe even seeing people wearing t-shirts with derogatory language on it, targeted at, a political opponent of the candidate they support. So, I think children are absolutely paying attention to that. I love what that you said, that children are paying attention. So many parents that I talk to don't think their kids are paying attention to politics, and that's just not what I have found in my, empirical research. Like they are definitely paying attention. They might not have sophisticated understandings of some of these policies or whatever, but they absolutely are impacted, both by the kinds of things they hear coming straight from a political leader, but also through the supporters of those leaders, including those that you're mentioning at these rallies.
I'm a lot older than you, and I know that the culture has changed in the time that I have been alive. There are things that we say and do now that would not have been acceptable at all in the 60s or 70s. It would have been shocking, in fact. And yet now, with these things, these words, these phrases, these accusations fly around. They've been flying around in small groups for a long time, but now they're vastly public because they're on television. And I've noticed that among commentators on TV, some of these words that used to be embargoed in broadcasting are being used. So the culture is coarsening. What does that mean for the long haul, Maggie? You're the sociologist here. If kids are being exposed to the B word and other bad words that we normally consider bad words, and bad behavior on the part of adults, what we would have considered to be bad behavior in the past, if they're being exposed to that regularly today, what's it going to be like in 10, 15, 20 years when these kids are adults? How coarse are we going to be?
Well, as a sociologist, I cannot predict the future, but I certainly can think about the past and how the past is shaped today. And I guess I would push back a little bit at this idea that, like kids of this generation are using worse language than kids of prior generations. I mean, I think we could probably think of some examples from history of nasty language that people use that we no longer use today, So I totally hear your point, but I guess what I'm suggesting is that, well, I guess I'm suggesting we don't know, but certainly the things that kids are exposed to in early childhood, middle childhood, shape what happens to them when they become adolescents and then when they become adults. So this idea that like they're not like the idea that they're being exposed to these things as 10-year-olds, I think, based on my research, my longitudinal research, I think that this will be a sort of a moment where they are really sort of learning about what it means to be an American citizen. And maybe that means using this language. I don't know.
So, Rachel, for a lot of members of this Gen Z generation, this would have been their first time to be able to vote legally. USA Today reported that their high voter turnout was driven mainly by abortion rights, but Business Insider claims this group gravitated toward the political right. I'm wondering if both can be true.
100%. I've spoken with so many young men in particular, both before the election and in the past week, who are both pro-choice and pro-Trump. I think Arizona is a great example of this because the state voted to elect President Trump, but also voted to pass an abortion amendment, and so as ballot measure. And so it shows that you can be both, believe in abortion access, reproductive health care, and also support Trump. It is not contradictory in the way that it may appear to be to political pundits or, operatives in that space.
And given everything I just talked to Maggie about the coarsening of the culture, that seems to be antithetical to conservative values, and yet this younger generation, Gen Z, is trending more to the right. How do they square that with conservative values?
No, it is a bit ironic, but I think we're looking at a different type of conservatism than the, let's say, even, Romney era or McCain era of conservatism that was for millennials, the previous generation of young voters. And I think social media plays a big role in shaping the normalization of rhetoric as well. You mentioned language that's used on broadcast, but when you're a young person and especially for today's youngest eligible voters, they spent essentially a year of their lives in middle school or the beginning of high school at home during the COVID pandemic, just scrolling endlessly on TikTok and YouTube. There's a lot of talk about the creator content and the podcast ecosystem that helped President-elect Trump achieve a victory last week. And social media, had a huge part in that. And these young people have just grown up with that being a normal place where they're consuming politics and consuming it frequently, even if it's not inherently overtly political content. A lot of the cultural content that they're consuming is politically coded, especially for young men. And when you look at the young people who are paying attention, of course they're paying attention because they have this device in their hand and they're inundated with notifications constantly. And I think that plays a role in shaping this new conservatism that we're seeing based on the types of figures who have generated massive audiences, especially of young people.
And we should mention that for years, broadcasting has been governed by rules and regulations, which we may talk about that, but there's nothing governing these social media platforms and the things that come in on your phone. And that's where young people get most all of their news. They don't even know what a television is, or a radio for that matter. We'll come back and talk more about this new voter and what they voted for and how they had their political opinions formed and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the impact of young voters on this election and how they have been impacted by what they witnessed in this election, both the Gen Zers who voted many for the first time this time around, and younger people who will be coming up through the system in the next 4 years to 8 years. We're talking about that with Rachel Gianfaza, publisher of the Up and Up Substack. She used to be with CNN and MTV News and others. She publishes freelance articles in the New York Times and other publications. Margaret Hagerman is also with us, a sociologist who used to be at Wake Forest, I believe. And is that correct? No, that must be, excuse me, that's our other guest who is not here right now. Excuse me. Margaret Hagerman is a sociologist at Mississippi State University and author of Children of a Troubled Time, Growing Up with Racism in Trump's America. In that book, Margaret, you focused on 10 to 13-year-olds. Why?
So what we know from developmental psychology is that children in that time, you know, of their lives typically are starting to think in more ideological ways. They're having more time with peers outside the home. They're, you know, they're involved in more activities, things of that nature. And so I think it's a really fascinating time period in young people's lives to think about when they start forming really powerful notions about how the social world operates. And most of my research looks at how they develop ideas about race and racism. But obviously that connects directly with thinking about politics in American society, as well as thinking about democracy. I mean, kids are starting to learn about some of these concepts in more concrete ways at school, starting, you know, depending on where they're going to school. And so I think this age is really interesting. I also know from looking at the data that the ideas that children produce in middle childhood don't necessarily determine the ideas that they will hold on to later in their lives, but they certainly shape them. And so, you know, we've been having a conversation about these, you know, voters that are, you know, just voted in this election, these Gen Z voters. Well, those are the kids that I talked to when they were in middle school. And so it's really interesting to think about the fact that those kids that are in this book I just published were in middle school when Trump was elected the first time. And well, now they've in this election.
Did you see glimmers of the trends we witnessed in this last election when you talked to these young people when they were 10 to 13 years old? And if so, what was leading them in that direction?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, I do qualitative research, so I can't look at any big trends or predict anything, you know, at the population level. But certainly there were all kinds of children who were very supportive of Trump the first time around. These were white children. These were white children that I interviewed in Mississippi, where I live, but also in Massachusetts, where I grew up, not the actual towns, but, you know, the states that are very different politically. And there were kids that were that said things like, you know, Trump's going to make the world a better place for the USA. You know, this is a 10-year-old that said this in 2016. I think there was a 10-year-old that said that. But the point is that he might not have actually been able to vote in this election. But the point is that a lot of these kids were 12, 13, and they were expressing ideas like that. They thought that Trump would make America better.
And a 10-year-old, and I don't mean to be pejorative, but a 10-year-old knows nothing. I mean, they may have an opinion, but it's based on paper-thin logic. Where are they getting the information that informs that opinion?
Well, I think the kids actually know a lot more than we give them credit for.
Really?
And I think there's this assumption that I try to challenge in some of my research that kids are simply reproducing the ideas of their parents. And while, of course, parents matter, parents play a huge role in shaping where kids go to school, where they live, the kinds of activities they do, which then in turn shape, you know, the ways that kids think. Children also have agency and they think for themselves. And anyone that spent time with a kid knows that they don't always just listen to you and do what you tell them to do, you know. And so I think the same, that analogy works for this stuff too. I mean, there are children who disagree with their grandparents. You know, there's been lots of discussion around family fights around politics, and that is part of this. And so I think that, you know, for the kids in my study, some of the 10 and 11-year-olds weren't quite using social media in the ways that Rachel was talking about. Maybe the older ones were starting to a little bit, at least back when I did this data collection. But they certainly are exposed to, like, having a TV on in the background, or having a radio maybe on in the background or in the car when their parents are driving them somewhere. There was one little girl, in fact, who told me that she got up every morning and watched the news before school with her cup of tea. So, you know, I think that it is possible that kids are are either really engaged in politics, like this kid was, or they're simply growing up in American society in a very polarized moment where, of course, they're going to be absorbing the ideas around them.
So, Rachel, we previous generations got most of their information on a daily basis from a newspaper or from the evening news on television or from the radio. And then this digital age dawned and has changed everything. Some people, young people, they don't even have a television. Most don't have a radio. They don't use it. If they have it, they wouldn't know how to turn it on. Instead, they surf on their phones, they listen to podcasts, they get their news from social media, which strikes me to be a fundamental shift. And we have been witnessing the results of that because none of this information or a great deal of it is unvetted, I would guess. In the mid-60s, a Canadian communication theorist by the name of Marshall McLuhan coined the phrase, "The media is the message," positing that it is the communication medium itself that should be the primary focus of study and not the messages that it carries. If that is true, does it hold true in your mind when it comes to digital media?
Certainly. And you know, similar to Margaret, I would push back and say that young people certainly are paying attention to what's going on in the world around them and have led social movements throughout history. I think we're seeing, you know, with the rise of social media, the way that someone is able to organize and facilitate these movements directly through the device in their hand. And most of the, you know, positive rhetoric around the former president, now president-elect, this cycle did come through the channels, the new channels that, you know, no one was talking about podcasts in the same way or TikTok in the same way. In 2020, there was a little bit of talk about TikTok, much less about podcasts, and certainly not in 2016. And so looking at the way that, you know, former President Trump, now President-elect Trump, sat down with these hosts and had one-on-one conversations where they were able to, he was across the couch from a range of personalities, whether it was figures with Barstool Sports or Joe Rogan or Andrew Schultz on the Flagrant podcast. He was able to have a conversation that went deeper than just talking points. And what I've heard as a positive reaction from young people about those experiences was that it humanized him. They got to see a side of him that they wouldn't see in a press conference or that they wouldn't see when reporters are asking direct targeted questions. And so when you say, you know, it's the media, the form of the media is what the message is. I think that for Trump, who, as we mentioned in the beginning of this episode, you know, his rhetoric flies in the face of a cancel culture and a political correctness that has been pervasive in American politics and American culture broadly for the past many years. For young people who are craving authenticity, who don't want to feel like they're walking on eggshells with what they can and cannot say, the ability to see that unfiltered content through these podcasts and that are clipped, that's important to note too. The podcasts themselves, a person might not be sitting down and listening to the full thing. They're seeing clips of it shared on TikTok, on Instagram Reels, on X. And the, you know, X had a big role to play in this as well, formerly Twitter, given Elon Musk and his role in the 2024 election. You know, Trump capitalized on this media as a form of communication. I think we will see an expedited transition away from traditional media as a result over the course of the next 4 years.
I've lost my train of thought here. Kamala Harris, she also appeared on non-traditional, for a presidential candidate, non-traditional platforms. She was on The View, I think. I think she did Howard Stern's SiriusXM radio show, a couple of other places. Did she just not do it enough, or did she do the wrong ones if she wanted to attract young people, young voters, Gen Z voters?
So she went on Call Her Daddy, which is a show hosted by Alex Cooper,
right.
Is deeply popular with young women. It actually received a lot of pushback because Alex Cooper's audience is really split across the board politically speaking, and she noted that. You know, the advice that I heard from young people I spoke with, especially young women in the last few days of the campaign, was that she should have done as much of that as possible. I heard from so many people they wish she had gone on Joe Rogan, similar to Trump. But you know, when you go on something like Call Her Daddy, it was a strategic play and it was smart. She was trying to jack up the margins with women, and she did perform really well with young women. Young women backed Harris by 18 points. So there's a massive gender gap in support from young people for the respective candidates. But you know, it's hard to say that whether or not she went on Joe Rogan, she would have dramatically increased her standing with young men. But I don't think it could have hurt.
There's an attitude on some of these podcasts. It's unfiltered. It is young. It is hip. It is edgy, which is makes it very attractive to young people, Margaret. And that leads us back to rhetoric. I think that's coming from candidates and their surrogates in their commercials, on the campaign trail, in these forums where they go for long form interviews with. Some people in the bro culture, for instance, in advertising, political advertising has long been negative, often frightening, usually exaggerated, untrue in many cases. But we're watching candidates say things, act untraditionally, as candidates, even as human beings, in ways that would have been unacceptable. So I'm curious as to how parents should deal with that with their children. Are they calling it out? Should they call it out? Or just let the kids make up their own mind about what they're seeing?
Well, one of the things that I think that is going on here is about emotions. And I think that all of the things we were just talking about, you know, Trump was appealing to people's emotions in different ways, right? So he made people feel something that drew them to him, like these young men voters that we're talking about. And you can see that with these kids that I interviewed, and you can see that with their parents, that people are developing emotions about politics and about race and about other things before they even have full-fledged ideas figured out about them. And so one of the emotions that has been really strong, or was really strong in the data that I collected, was fear. You know, when Trump was elected his first term, all of the children in my book expressed fear, but that fear was aimed at different sources. And you know, they were feeling that fear in different ways and for different reasons. And that fear wasn't connected necessarily to policies. It was connected to rhetoric. And so I think that we have to understand that it's not just what people say, it's how they make people feel when they're saying things. And by people, I mean political leaders, whoever they might be. And so I think that in terms of parenting, that's something that's really important to recognize. I mean, I think recognizing that young people are developing emotions that are tied to race, that are tied to politics, that are tied to gender, they're tied to all kinds of things when they're young, and helping young people navigate that is really important. You know, I think that there's so much evidence that children are thinking in more sophisticated ways than we often think about the social world, and parents often silence them, don't listen to them, don't listen to their questions, don't take them seriously, and so then they're left to talk to each other. It's kind of like how kids learn about sex, right? Like if you don't teach them anything in terms of sex ed, they're going to get information, they're going to get the answers to their questions, but they're probably going to get those answers from their peers or from TikTok or from somewhere like that. So I do think parents have an important role to play if they want to raise children that do not embrace, for example, dehumanizing rhetoric. So I do think that parents have a role to play.
Well, the question, I guess, is are they exercising that role? Because a lot of what passed for normal during the course of this last election cycle would have been considered repugnant, not just abnormal, repugnant. And parents would have done everything in their power to shield their children from that. Is that happening? Or it seemed to be that it didn't seem to matter to a majority of Americans, which means something has shifted.
So that last point, I really have been thinking a lot about, like, what does it mean that the majority of Americans were on board with some of this rhetoric? I do want to point out, though, that, you know, young people are not a monolith. Like, there was a lot of people that didn't vote for Trump, and there's a lot of parents that have been raising children to be critical, to be thoughtful, to think for themselves even, and to reject some of this violent language and violent, you know, ways of thinking. And in the previous, when Trump was elected the first time, which I keep mentioning because it's what I have data on, but there were children that said things to me like, I felt sick to my stomach. I was so angry. I cried. I felt like the world turned upside down. down. I was scared Trump would, you know, send us back to Africa. These are black children that I talked to. So, I mean, there are lots of children, children of color, of, you know, lots of different racial and ethnic identities, as well as white children who are not on board with this type of language and not on board with a lot of these things and even the issue. So I think it's complicated, but I think it's also important to point out that there are many children and young people who, as Rachel mentioned, are engaged in youth organizing and have been powerful players in our nation's history and even today in thinking about alternatives to what's happening. So it'll be curious to see how the next couple of years play out.
Prior to President Biden's withdrawal from this race, a lot was being made, Rachel, of the age of both candidates, but particularly the president, because he is older than Donald Trump, but not by much. And now we have elected the oldest president we've ever elected in our history. And the majority of people, including young people, a lot of young people, voted for this old guy as opposed to making a choice for a younger candidate, a woman whose victory would have made history on several fronts. Given all the emphasis that was placed on how old these candidates by Biden and Trump have been, it's puzzling why this happened. Was age not a factor after all?
A great question. You know, to Margaret's point, this generation, of course, is not a monolith and did vote, you know, the majority of young people did vote for Harris. But I think we saw, you know, compared to other recent elections, the largest share of young people voting for a Republican candidate than in recent memory. And he, of course, he was older than Vice President Harris. When I would talk with young voters in listening sessions and one-on-one conversations over the course of the past year, age was not necessarily so much the concern. It was more so the issues that the candidates were championing. I think, you know, there were reservations when it was a Biden-Trump rematch about the fact that, you know, it was two older white men in particular. That's something that comes up in conversations. And I definitely heard that from young people who supported the vice president at the ballot box. But again, I've always come back to this idea that young people are voting for the issues that they care about. And that is what was most motivating to them in terms of why they decided to cast a ballot.
And if they're getting their information from social media, much of which I think is conservative-based, I could be off-base. There are a few sites like The Politics Girl that are liberal, but most of it is conservative and kind of bro-y. Is that influencing how they feel? How about these issues? And I have about 20 seconds.
I mean, the media ecosystem is very fragmented, and there are a range of perspectives on social media. There is a section, certainly, that is more conservative, but there are a ton of left-leaning creators as well.
Rachel Gianfassa is the publisher of the Up and Up Substack. Margaret Hagerman is with us, a sociologist from Mississippi State. We'll continue in just a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about young voters and young people and how their political opinions are influenced and shaped with Rachel Gianfassa, publisher of the Up and Up Substack, a publication which focuses on Gen Zers. Margaret Hagerman is with us, sociologist at Mississippi State and author of Children of a Troubled Time, Growing Up with Racism in Trump's America. The political winds, Rachel, seem to have shifted, at least among many young voters, Gen Z voters. The Gallup Poll organization and the Walton Family Foundation found that a greater number of Gen Zers see themselves as more conservative than their parents. Do we understand why?
So that research, which I wrote about back last March, showed that Gen Zers were more likely to say they were more conservative than their parents than millennials were 20 years ago. So I've asked young people why that shift has occurred, why they believe that shift has occurred. And in large part, it is what they shared was because of social media. And then again, this idea of political correctness, which I think go hand in hand, and a frustration with some of the political correct language that has been disseminated. There's also been, of course, we've seen a pushback, a sort of a culture war of sorts in with regard to K-12 curriculum, which I'm sure Margaret can speak more about as well. That is something that has resonated with a portion of young people. And then, where do they go to talk about all of this and make sense of all of it? They go to social media. And it's not just the creators who they're talking to online, but it's chat rooms amongst themselves as
So
well.
how big is this group that identifies as more conservative than their parents? Because these are the people, these young first-time Gen Z voters are the people who were in college very recently, and many of them if they went to college. And it is on college campuses that a lot of comedians are refusing to play because of political correctness. Nobody thinks their jokes are funny because you're going to microaggress or offend someone, and this is the population that is offended.
Yeah, so this was actually Gen Z teens. So it was people who have not yet gone to college at the time that they were polled. And it was it's just 14% of 13 to 17-year-old Gen Zers who said they were more conservative than their parents, but that's double the amount of millennials who said the same. 7% of 13 to 17-year-old millennials said that 20 years ago. So it's still a small portion. Again, this is teenagers. This is not students who are on college campuses. But what I will say about the discourse on college campuses is that I've heard frustrations from this cohort. Again, we're talking about a specific group. These are people who are more conservative, which is not the vast majority of young people, though it's a growing share of young people as compared to prior generations.
I'm going to bring Margaret back into this, but I'm just curious about something because it is true that a lot of young people don't watch television. They just don't. They certainly don't watch the evening news. They have walked away from newspapers. They may read articles from papers on their phone, either directly from the paper website or usually because it's been reposted someplace else. Why? Why don't they watch television? Why don't they consume traditional media to a greater degree? Why are they depending on these social media platforms? And do they understand that these social media platforms are uncurated, they're unedited, there are no gatekeepers? And is that why? Because they like it that way?
I mean, that's definitely a part of it, but I will say also that a lot of the content they're getting from social media is from actual news outlets who are posting their news on social media because that's where the audience is. So you could be looking at a CNN, a Fox, an NBC, New York Times, whatever it may be, on social media. And I do hear, I wrote a story over the summer that was looking specifically at the creator space on the right online and who young conservatives are listening to. And they said that they appreciated the perspective-based content that these creators were putting out, but that they also relied on legacy media or traditional media to confirm that what they were seeing was accurate because they are well aware of mis and disinformation. So yes, they're aware, but I mean, cable, it's expensive. It's not pervasive. Most people don't have a TV. So they might be consuming stuff on Netflix or streaming, but they don't have cable in their home necessarily.
Yeah. So, Margaret, there is this backlash, evidently, against political correctness. And the first Trump term seemed to have grown out of a backlash response to Obama, the Obama years, our first black president. The mere fact that he was black seemed to have gotten under a lot of people's skin. Trump's election gave permission to many of those people who felt threatened by that to be more public about their views that many would say are racist, even white nationalist. Well, now Trump is going to be president again. Does that mean that racial progress, if there ever was any, was a mirage? Does it mean that a younger generation of voters who grew toward voting age under the first Trump presidency have a different attitude about race and racism as well?
So there's a lot of research on racial attitudes across time. So we have data that goes back, to the 60s, 70s, 80s, looking at racial attitudes, particularly white racial attitudes. And so what we know is that this logic that some of my college students sometimes have that like, oh, when all the old racist white people die off, then like we won't have racism anymore. That is certainly not supported by the survey data and this racial attitude data. Racism, as you probably know, it shifts. It takes different forms. The overt racism of the Jim Crow era is not this doesn't take the same form as the colorblind racism that we saw during the Obama years. That might make we'll see what happens in the next couple of years if this white nationalist sort of explicit form of racism comes across. So scholars like me study this, like how racism shifts in form and in expression, but ultimately how it's still about the same issues. It's still about white supremacy, and it's still about the sense of group threat that many white people in this country feel when racial progress is made, like the election of the first black president in the case of Obama, or going back historically, thinking about Reconstruction period and then what came after Reconstruction, Jim Crow. Right. So there's been this history of back and forth of sort of backlash like you're talking about. And so I definitely saw evidence when I interviewed these kids in 2017 that they were embracing what I considered to be, rhetoric that was on the periphery of the far right. I mean, there's been some really important research. One of my colleagues, Cynthia Idris Miller, she runs the American Polarization Lab at American University, and she's found that there is this growing like mainstreaming of far right hate. And so I think that we need to be on the lookout for that if we care about living in a multiracial democracy where we value people's humanity. So I think that's something that we need to think about when we're thinking about young people, what they're learning in schools, what they're learning on college campuses, and then what they're not learning.
In the course of doing your research, Margaret, you had one young person, a child, tell you racism is fine. Was that person in the minority of the people that you talked to, or is that a prevailing theory?
So that child and a number of other kids in the study, these were Trump supporters, by the way. These were all white children. They and also in Mississippi and Massachusetts. And these kids were embracing what we talk about as sociologists, as racial apathy, this sort of idea that racism doesn't matter. Like, it's not. Racism doesn't exist anymore, which is what I heard from kids during the Obama era. Instead, it's, yeah, racism exists and it's fine. It doesn't affect me. Who cares? What's interesting though is that when I talked to those kids a little bit more carefully, racism absolutely mattered to them. They were very had very strong opinions about issues that I think we would all agree are related to racism in the United States. And so, things like thinking about, this so-called threat of immigrants, for example, right? That was something that they cared deeply about at the same time that they said they didn't care about racism. So that's sort of the tension that I explore in this book about between what people say and then how they feel.
If you go back to the time of the Dixiecrats and Strom Thurmond, and this is pre-civil rights, there was great fear about black racial progress in America, and there were groups of people who were doing everything in their power to stop it and reverse it. Are we witnessing a shift? You don't hear much about that anymore, although there's still undercurrents of that. What you're hearing more about today is fear of immigrants, particularly from south of the border. Has that replaced white racism against black people? Is that the new racism?
No, I think that racism contains all of that. I think there's plenty of examples of anti-black racism in America today, just like there's plenty of examples of racism against many racial and ethnic groups in America's history. So I think that the issue of immigration is getting a lot more attention right now, and that's racialized in a very particular way, that issue. But certainly when we start thinking about many other issues that voters are to care about, such as thinking about healthcare access. There's a great book by Jonathan Metzl called Dying of Whiteness, where these white voters will literally vote against things that will benefit them because they don't want to see black people get access to those kinds of resources like healthcare, education, and even changes to gun laws. So, anyway, I don't think that we're in any way one type of, hate is replacing another. I think this is all part of a larger system of white supremacy and a desire to maintain a hierarchy that I think some white people feel is at threat.
Rachel, this last election was framed to greater or lesser degrees by both sides of the aisle as one in which the future of democracy teetered on the brink. Did that message not get through? Did young voters simply not believe it, or are young voters more open to a strongman approach to government?
So this came up sometimes in conversations with young people. I was at the polls on election day, and I will say I heard it more than as sort of a last minute, I'm voting because of democracy type of sentiment. I think, you have people on both sides of the aisle who believed that their candidate is the best for democracy and fearful that the other candidate would be the end of democracy. And so even if the message was getting through, it was a very hyper-polarized message where both sides felt they were in the best position to keep democracy stable. I do believe it matters to young people. Young people especially are very, they crave autonomy. And when I ask young people, what is motivating you to vote beyond the issues, it oftentimes is, this is my civic duty. We live in a democracy. It's my voice. It's my way to make my voice heard. I do think that sentiment definitely holds true for young people. So I think it was more so, the strong belief that each candidate was uniquely positioned to be the future for the country.
Margaret, if I understand your research correctly, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the result is that you have concluded that presidents have an impact on the way people think. That includes children. As they watch presidents in office, what they say, how they say it, how they conduct themselves, what others say about them, all impacts them. Do these young people begin to view these things as normal, as acceptable, or do they have, are they savvy enough to see a disconnect between what they're seeing and hearing and what they've been taught by their parents or their teachers or what they learn in Sunday school?
It's a great question. And again, I love that you're recognizing in that question the fact that kids are getting messages from so many different places, including, religious organizations, including even experiences they might have, observations they make about the world around them. There's some famous political science research that talks about this concept of generational imprinting, that the time in which you come of voting age, the issues that are present really impact you not only in that moment, but for the rest of your life. Like that really, the time that you come of age is like, of age, meaning of voting age, is a really important moment in your development of your political identity and your partisan identity. And so I do think that there's something to that theory that relates to this. Again, I'm not a political scientist, I think they probably have a lot more to say about your question in response to your question. But I do think that yes, my research shows that the political landscape in which children come of age, and that includes for me before they can vote, they're still political participants even if they can't vote. They're living in the society, they're participating in it, they're experiencing it, and that matters. That matters for how they understand their own position in this society, and it matters for how they view other people, and it matters for how they just determine who is a member of my in-group and who's a member of that out-group.
A lot of the rhetoric that we hear coming from the right, not just Donald Trump, but others on the right, bears the mark of a bully. That's something we discourage in children, and yet many have found this an attractive quality in some politicians. What message does that send to young people, and how is it likely to change their behavior?
Well, we already know because this is the second time around, with Trump at least. We know what happened in schools across America in 2016. We have all kinds of evidence. One of the things I did for this book was to research every single study I could possibly find across lots of disciplines and look at what was the impact of Trump's policies and rhetoric on kids. And one of the biggest findings was about what happened in school the day after the election, or into thinking about once his term actually began the following year. So we already know that there was, such an increase in racial violence, homophobic violence, transphobic violence. We know that there was an increase in, kids feeling scared to even go to school. A lot of schools characterize this. You might remember actually kids chanting "Build the Wall" at like a middle school in Michigan. That got a lot of attention back in 2016. But a lot of schools characterize this behavior as bullying. Like, like you've pointed out. And I guess my point is that I think this is different than your classic bullying. This is about dehumanizing hateful language and behavior. And quite frankly, I don't think schools were prepared for that back in 2016. I don't think that, I mean, I've talked to a lot of school administrators, that people were not prepared for that. So I do hope that this time around, and right now, I hope my message to school administrators is to start thinking about what you're going to do when you have groups of kids that are fighting with each other at school, because some of them don't think the other group deserves to exist even, potentially, depending upon people's, you know, how extreme they are.
At his first inauguration, Trump spoke of American carnage. During this campaign, he painted an extremely dark picture of America, with unsubstantiated charges being overrun by illegal immigrants, rampant crime, etc. How do you see this, that rhetoric, and what he will probably do to follow through on that, Rachel, in 30 seconds or less? How do you see that impacting the next election cycle of young people?
Oh, well, you know, it's crazy to already be talking about the next election cycle. But one thing, just to end on sort of a more optimistic note, is that I do hear from a lot of young people who want to move away from all of this, who want to come together. So I can only hope that they drive us forward.
Rachel Genfaza is publisher of the Up and Up Substack. Margaret Hagerman is a sociologist at Mississippi State, author of Children of a Troubled Time, Growing Up with Racism in Trump's America. Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.